Yeah, I think I understand the mix-up now. I'm actually heading back to Canada first thing tomorrow morning, and not for business, it's actually a vacation. I'm going to be taking my son to this spectacular mountain place my wife and I have enjoyed for a couple of years. And I think Diana was thinking it's going to take Hugh a long time to get my son ready for this trip. So she gave me a day off, and I didn't know about it, so... But glad to be here. And yeah, I spent last week in Canada, Eastern Canada. I was in Toronto, Hamilton, a place called Mississauga, and Burlington. And if you're not familiar with the geography, you know, Toronto is a city of about 6 million people. But then as you go west of Toronto, there's just basically cities all the way down to Buffalo. And so I was kind of doing ministry through those different cities. But first of all, I want to have a really big thank you for all of you for celebrating my birthday. It was spectacular what you did, and it's going to pay for a lot of our expenses up there in Canada, so thank you. It's a tremendous blessing. But when I arrived in Toronto, I went to a suburb called Mississauga. And some of you might know I got my PhD at the University of Toronto, so that's quite a few years ago, to be honest, decades ago. And when I was there, Mississauga was basically one-bedroom bungalows. It's now 50 and 60-story buildings, so it's got nearly a million people, and so it really changed a lot. But I was speaking in a Coptic church. In fact, it was Canada's largest Coptic church. And, you know, Coptic means Egyptian Orthodox. In Egypt, you have two kinds of Christians. You've got the Presbyterians, and then you've got the Coptics. And the Coptics were like 10% of the Egyptian population. They were. What's happened over the past 30 years is that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and others have really gone after the Presbyterians and basically chased them all out. They've been out for quite some time. But now they're going after the Coptics. So there's this huge exodus of Coptic Christians leaving Egypt for places like Canada. And so this church is growing rapidly. And most Coptic churches are, you know, they're Eastern Orthodox, but really not evangelical at all. Many of them are into liberal theology. This church was different. Solid doctrine. And very evangelical. And what really pleased me is just how they're reaching out to non-Egyptians. And so they're bringing in a lot of other people. They notice. They said, Canadian churches don't tend to be evangelical. And, you know, we've always looked at our mission field as being Egyptians. But, hey, we need to take responsibility where the rest of the Canadian churches aren't. So this church had eight fathers, so it gives you an idea of the size of the church. And but they were thrilled to have us there, and our chapter showed up, our Toronto chapter, and you know, we sold out of our material very quickly. But what was really exciting, just how many university professors and students showed up for the talk. And I spoke on Genesis 1, and I think that was providential, because throughout the Canadian church is this idea that it's impossible to reconcile Genesis with science. And, you know, just being able to share there, hey, this is how it can be done. And they just said, wow, this is just such a liberating thing that we can actually look at the book of Genesis as teaching real history rather than a story of myth, like it's often propagated. Then I went from there to the American Scientific Affiliation meeting. That's a Christian organization, although Christian in quotes, in the sense that their doctrinal statement's only three lines. If you believe in the Trinity, you're in. And so they have quite a spectrum. I mean, and, you know, my past experience with their meetings is about 90% theistic evolutionists. And what I realize is we have a lot of friends at that meeting, and a lot of people came up. In fact, what was really a thrill for me is three scientists came up and said they came to Christ through reading a Reasons to Believe book. And four of them said they were having a crisis in faith, and reading our material saved their faith. And they realized, I don't have to choose between the book of nature and the book of scripture. But you know, a lot of the conference is why we can't trust Genesis. So I gave a talk on why we can trust Genesis. So very well attended and a very positive response. Yes.
See, what's the rule in Canada? I mean, are there some laws against evangelizing?
There are no laws against evangelizing in Canada.
Okay.
There's total freedom. I think what's happened is it goes back, about 150 years. In the 1850s and the 1860s, there was a dramatic revival across Canada where literally within a 15-year period, the country became 80 to 85% evangelical Christians. But what happened in Canada is they drew the conclusion evangelism is finished here in Canada. We need to go overseas. And to this day, the Canadian church, on a per capita, per dollar basis, sends 20 times as many missionaries overseas as American churches do. You know, that's still their focus. Evangelism is overseas. But I think the irony is they're evangelizing in countries that have got 10 times as many Christians per capita as Canada does. So, and what's happening is the nations they're evangelizing are sending missionaries to Canada. So, and the other thing that I think is problematic is that, you know, I tell people I really didn't get to know Christians until I was 27. I was basically coming to Caltech. And I now recognize the problem is that, number one, Canada has far fewer Christians per capita. Not as few as you might think. It's probably 5 to 6% evangelical Christians. But the problem is they live in their own communities. And so I now know, for example, outside of Vancouver where I grew up, there's this large suburb that's 80% plus evangelical Christians. If you're a Christian, that's where you live.
There's a radio network in Canada. I picked up on my internet radio called UCB Canada. Have you heard of it?
Well,
United Christian Broadcasting Canada.
I was there. I was actually there to do an interview with a national network, a group called Crossroads TV. They have a Christian network all across Canada. They broadcast in the U.S. as well. So they were interviewing me on the Navigating Genesis book. And yes, there's Christian radio, Christian TV, but the Christians tend to live in their own suburbs. And so where I grew up in Vancouver was less than 1% Christian. And likewise, where I went to university in Toronto, less than 1% Christian. But if you go north of Toronto, there's what they call the Holland area, very rich agricultural area. And I remember driving through this one town there. And it's a town of about 4,000 people, and we counted 50 churches. So, I mean, there are communities like that. And that's typical of everywhere except Alberta. Alberta, you actually have Christians living in the population, but virtually everywhere else, they form their own communities. And so it's kind of a retreat motif. Let's kind of build. And the problem there is that reasons to believe is not that welcome in those communities because they're predominantly young earth. And so I've yet to speak in one of those suburbs. So we're trying to make that happen. Doors are starting to open up, at least the one outside of Vancouver. We're hoping that will materialize. But that's, you know, Christianity is different in Canada, very much different. So, but we're thrilled about this Coptic church because they're really right there in the population and they're reaching out. And incidentally, that's been true of ethnic churches in Canada in general. I mean, the second largest church in Canada is a Chinese church, and it's in Toronto. I've spoken there, and they've now realized we have to reach out to non-Chinese. It's a church of 3,500 people, and finally they're saying we need to have services in English, not just Mandarin, and you know, let's reach out to these pagan Canadians.
Are there First Nations, also known as Indigenous churches?
Yes, they do have churches for them as well. So, anyway, it was encouraging what we saw there at the ASA meeting, but I also got to attend some of the more problematic lectures. In fact, there was one biochemist where he was basically saying it's time to abandon this ridiculous idea that Adam was a real person and that we're descended from two people. And also went a little bit further and said this notion of original sin is flat out wrong. Now he did say, don't get me wrong, I believe we're all sinners, but there is no original sin. So the people asked him, well, where did sin come from then? And he kind of dodged that question. But it gives you an idea of some of the crisis of doctrine we're facing today. People are looking at the genetic evidence showing that we're descended from a large population rather than two is so compelling that they're saying it's time to abandon this old idea that Paul was actually telling the truth when he wrote the book of Romans. And or that when Jesus referred to Adam, he was simply accommodating the culture of his time. Because people ask that question, well, are you actually saying that Jesus was getting it wrong? He says, oh no. Jesus was simply trying to fit in with the culture and just parroting what the culture believed at that time. Although I'm not sure that the culture was all that favorable towards Jesus anyway. So as we can see in the New Testament. But we live at a unique time. I mean, these kinds of challenges would have been unheard of, say, 20, 30 years ago. And, as an astronomer listening to these geneticists speak, it says, all their arguments are based on theoretical genetics models. And what's interesting is where we do have experiments to test the models, the experiments show a very different result than the model. And so I was talking to some biologists there and just saying, in astronomy, we always wait for concordance between experiments, observations, and theory. And if all we got is one or two of those legs, we're very tentative about our claims. For obvious reasons, we've run into some serious issues. I mean, I can tell you that 15 years ago, we were looking at stars and realized the stars were measuring to be older than the universe. Now, can you say, well, I guess we're wrong about the universe, or I guess we're wrong about the stars? No, what happened is the team of astronomers said, we need to go back and check our theoretical models of the burning history of stars and see if we missed something. Maybe we didn't accommodate sufficient data. And what they actually did is they went back into the laboratory and remeasured the spectra. Because, we kind of determine experimentally how old these stars are by looking at their spectral lines. And they said, have we misidentified some spectral lines? So they actually went back to the laboratory, redid those experiments, actually got some theoreticians to work out, from theoretical nucleosynthesis, what should these spectral lines look like? And they discovered they had to make tiny adjustments to the theory, tiny adjustments to the observations. And then they went back and looked at the stars and realized that there was a selection effect they didn't take into account. And, this took 15 years of very hard work. But at the end of it all, we had theory that matched the experiments, that matched the observations, that showed us that the stars were about a half billion years younger than the universe. But, in the very beginning, it looked like we were really in trouble. We're going to have to either throw out the theory, or throw out the experiments, or throw out the observations. And, of course, what the biologist told me, it says, well, in astronomy, you've got the luxury of actually having decent observations, decent experiments, and decent theory. So in biology, we typically only have one, and we're missing the other two. And I think that's, largely correct. And, but it doesn't mean that we should be throwing out the baby with the bathwater when we're seeing a problem on the theory. Yes?
Comment, if that's leading to a question. You had mentioned that the vast majority of people at the AFA conference were not Bible science, didn't believe Genesis at that time. As I talk to scholastic people in language, I find that they influence ministers and others believing that there is no science. They instead go for Assyrian creation accounts and have a great influence.
Yes.
Do you find any other sections of the scholastic community or anywhere that have that type of influence that we need to interdict and convince them that there is science?
That's a very good comment, because you're perceptive. That's exactly what's going on. People are saying, well, we actually look at how the Assyrians and the Babylonians framed their creation stories, And so they kind of use that to influence their interpretation of Genesis and say, you know, Genesis is a myth, just like these things are myths. And but it's written, I think, predominantly by the fact that they can't take the text as it is written and reconcile it with understood science. That's really what's going on. And therefore they're saying this must be some kind of mythical poetic text and it has nothing to do with science at all. The other thing I think is driving it is that they've been influenced by younger creationists. I mean, a lot of these people I were hearing were saying, you know, these days are consecutive 24-hour periods. The text is clear on that. And if that's the case, then we got a huge problem with the book of nature. And the way we're going to reconcile it is to say the entire text is simply a myth. It's saying nothing about science at all. Now, I was listening to a lot of Christian professors who teach at Christian universities and Christian colleges. And they were kind of saying, you know, our motivation is to try to save the faith of our students. And their students predominantly come from young earth backgrounds. So they're basically patting on the back and say, you know, you're right about the 24-hour days, but, you know, just recognize there's no science here, so don't worry about it. Now, what I was sharing with them is, if you're actually targeting unbelievers, people have not been to church, not been exposed to the Bible, and you show them Genesis 1 and 2, it's like they all take it as an account of real history. And therefore, the struggle with science is an issue. Or to quote Walt Kaiser, who still ranks among the world's foremost Hebrew linguists, says, if you actually read it in the literal Hebrew, the author couldn't have gone to a greater extent to tell you this is an account of natural history. He numbers the days. You got the phrase, and it was so. You got the comment, it was good. You look at the way the verbs are structured. It's like the author is going overboard to tell you that this is an account of natural history. It's a chronology. And the problem is, even in the English, if you show it to someone who's never been raised in a church, they always take it that way. And so evangelistically, we can't dodge the problem. And, you know, what was amazing to me at this ASA meeting is that none of them had really looked at what we're doing here in the class. Let's see what Psalm 104 has got to say. Let's see what Job has got to say. Or the idea that Job might actually predate in its content the book of Genesis. Because a lot of them were making the comment, this can't be an account of history. Look at everything the author leaves out. Well, the stuff he leaves out is quite well covered in Genesis. And one of the speakers I heard had done a study of the way the Assyrians and the Babylonians look at the sky above. And so he showed this picture of, quote, the brass dome with stars on the inside surface with holes inside to let the rain come through. And he says, this is what the Israelites believe. And this is what the word Rakai in the second creation day is saying. And therefore, we know that's nonsense. Therefore, we're forced to take this as a text that's not scientific at all. And really overlooking the fact that we have these metaphors we talked about in the class in Job 37 that really tells you what's going on. And the other thing I think that was disconcerting to me is this idea of how ignorant the ancients were about astronomy. So I was pointing out to them that the Egyptians well knew that the stars couldn't be just a few miles above us. They actually attempted to measure parallax, and they couldn't do it, which told them that the stars were extremely distant and were likely bodies just like the sun. And so, and their comment was, there's no way their astronomy was that good. Well, in fact, there's good evidence that it was. Yes?
Didn't they have the circumference of the Earth down to a very high precision?
They had figured out that the Earth was a sphere, and had measured it to 1% precision. They knew the sun was much bigger than the Earth. Now, they didn't have the sun measured as accurately as we can do today, because you know they're basically using eyeball plane geometry. But they had a rough idea of how far away the sun, the moon, how big they were. I mean, they knew that in an eclipse you could see the shadow of the Earth on the moon, and they were able to kind of measure the size of that shadow, like the arc that they could see. And that kind of gave an idea of the ratio of the Earth and the moon. And they knew that the planets were distant, but, you know, literally no more than hundreds of millions of miles away. because they could measure parallax. They saw differences between summer and winter positions. Whereas the stars, no matter what time of year you looked at them, they seemed to be in the same position. I mean, it takes a high-power telescope to notice that you get a little different of a position of a star in the summer than you do the winter time. And a remarkable thing there, they knew that the Earth went around the Sun. You say, well, where did this idea come from, that the Earth was the center? They didn't have algebra. They didn't have calculus. And so if you want to be able to predict the future positions of the planets, then it's easiest if you take an Earth perspective view. And this is kind of what Ptolemy did. He worked out a mathematical way to calculate the future positions of the planets using circles and epicircles. But the truth is, you know, Greek astronomers in Egypt and Greece well knew that the sun was the center of the solar system. But taking that perspective, they could not calculate with any degree of precision the future positions of the planets. So they came up with a mathematical construct. You know, as advanced as their astronomy is, they didn't have algebra. And lacking algebra was a huge handicap. But they had plane geometry. All those geometry theorems you learn in high school, they were developed by the Greeks centuries before Christ. Yes?
Your comment on the mathematical construct and the Ptolemaic model, when they knew better, kind of makes me think about our quantum mechanical philosophies today. The math works out to, you know, 10 plus decimal points when you use those models to predict experiments. But the theory doesn't correspond to what the actual situation is. So I kind of think that it's a construct that works down to the 10th decimal place. But the philosophy behind it is way wrong. Just like the Ptolemaic universe was way wrong compared to what they already knew was true. But we don't know what's true. All we know is, you know, if you have an infinite number of paths of this electron going from this point to that point, and you integrate them all together, you end up with the true path. But all those infinite paths don't exist. You just use them to make the calculation came out.
Well, I mean, we do the same today. I mean, when we do radio astronomy research, we actually invent two more dimensions of space. So we have the X, Y, and Z, that's length, width, and height, but we hypothesize that there's a U and a V. We call it the UV plane. And why do we do that? Because the math is a lot easier in five dimensions than it is in three dimensions. And so we take our three-dimensional data, do the calculations in five, bring it back down to three, and we publish a map. Now, the map is real. It's the real object. But, you know, because of mathematical limitations, we do this. That's similar to what was going on in ancient Egypt and Greece. You know, recognizing that the math was a lot easier if they just took this circle and epicircle idea, they were able to actually, with great precision, tell you where Jupiter and Saturn and Mars were going to be months and years ahead of time. You know, today we would use calculus to do that, but they didn't have calculus. They didn't even have algebra. And so, you know, mathematically, we're doing the same kind of things today. And of course, we know that those other two dimensions aren't real, but it does, you know, make for an easier mathematical pathway to the answer we want. So that goes on. Hey, Friday night, I got back Thursday night from Canada, and Friday night I spoke at a very interesting conference in Pasadena. It was a four-day conference. I was able to speak Friday night as a conference called Does God Play Dice? Wasn't that well attended, probably 30 people, but they're literally from all over the world. Everybody had a doctorate degree. So it was four academics only. Everybody was presenting papers. But the whole theme was, why do we see randomness in statistical mechanics, and why do we see uncertainty in quantum mechanics? And no doubt that that is there. And so what I was speaking on is, yes, there is randomness, there is uncertainty, and it looks like that means God's not determining everything, but what we need to realize is that the uncertainty is fine-tuned, and the randomness is also fine-tuned. And you know, that was something that was new to them. So I was just explaining a story about George Ellis, a South African theoretical physicist and astrophysicist, was attending a conference. You know, every few months, astronomers get together and have these conferences. But it was in a city where there was another conference, actually just 100 yards away. And it was a conference on nutrition. And so George Ellis walked into the wrong lecture hall. Instead of attending a lecture on theoretical astrophysics, he was attending a lecture on nutrition. And he was about to walk out, but something caught his attention. They were talking about these proteins and what kind of nutrition you need for these proteins to function. And when he recognized that the proteins they were talking about were transistors. And so he was able to quickly calculate that for these transistors to work properly so that animals, particularly important for animals, so these animals can live and thrive, the uncertainty of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle must be fine-tuned. Now, to give you an idea of the uncertainty, quantum mechanics tells you that if you measure with any great precision the position of the quantum particle, then you'll be uncertain about its momentum or energy level. Or if you're really certain about the energy level, you're going to be uncertain about the position. And I think it'll be easier if you understand the position uncertainty. So if I got a quantum particle and I measure its energy level with high precision, the uncertainty in its position will be roughly plus or minus half a mile. So, yeah, it's huge. But if you were to make it a little bit smaller, those transistors that are crucial for our survival would fail. And if you make the uncertainty a little bit bigger, they would also fail. They have to be that uncertain in order to operate. And likewise, in statistical mechanics, like you've got cells inside your body, and Richard knows all about this. There's these cells that contain these motors, and the motors function on Brownian movement. Everybody here, you know what Brownian movement is?
Yeah, okay.
I've got an engineer here. He knows what Brownian movement is. It's basically this thermodynamic principle that if you've got a system of gas or liquid at a very microscopic level, you'll notice that these particles randomly move around. And so, for example, the higher the temperature, the greater the amount of random movement. I think that's easy to comprehend. But there's actually these little motors inside the cell that are like ratchets. And so Brownian movement at the quantum level will actually cause the motor to jump forward, but there's a ratchet that stops it from going back. And so with Brownian movement, you can actually get steady forward movement. But if the Brownian movement is too violent, you destroy the machine. And if it's not violent enough, that ratchet won't work. So there again, there's an idea of the fine-tuning that takes place there. And, it's all based on a debate that was going on between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein, where Niels Bohr, the quantum physicist, the father of quantum mechanics, said, God plays dice and doesn't really control things. Einstein said, God does control things. It's a deterministic universe. And, we humans experience the randomness and uncertainty, but God doesn't. Or to put it another way, God does play dice, but he very carefully designs the dice to get the results that he wants.
He plays with loaded dice,
exactly. Well, because these were all people with PhDs in the sciences, I was able to get through that quite quickly and spent most of my time saying, okay, this is a property of the laws of physics that God chose. And given the laws of physics that he chose, we have to have this uncertainty and we have to have this randomness, and it is fine-tuned, and God controls the fine-tuning. But why the laws of physics? And that's where I was able to get into the content of why the universe is the way it is, that the laws of physics are actually selected by God and designed by God to be tools in his hands to eliminate evil and suffering efficiently and quickly and bring redemption to the greatest number of people. Kind of what I've been doing here in the class is saying, pick any major creation text in the Bible and notice that it always brings up redemption. And what we see in Romans 8 when it talks about entropy, probably the most dramatic example of randomness in statistical mechanics, how that entropy, the law of decay, will remain in effect until the full number of human beings who will receive redemption has been reached. And once that's reached, evidently entropy will no longer exist. There is no entropy in the new creation, because there's no sin, there's no evil in new creation, and no possibility for sin or evil in new creation. Anyway, that got into a conversation that lasted a couple more hours about why the laws of physics are different in new creation where they are in the present creation. So, hey, let me talk to you. This has been one of the most exciting weeks. I mean, I was doing all this speaking, but also a lot of material got published in the scientific literature, and you'll see it on a lot of the tweets I've been giving. But one concerns a discovery looking at the engineering of hummingbird wings. You know, and hummingbirds actually like little miniature helicopters, and it's been a mystery to scientists exactly how birds are able to hover. It's one thing for them to fly, but to hover takes a huge amount of energy. And of course, the hummingbird is basically taking in pure sugar almost all day long in order to be able to do its hovering thing. But a group of engineers actually looked at the wing structure of the hummingbirds, and they compared them to the very latest technology in helicopter rotors, and discovered that the hummingbirds are as efficient or more efficient than our most advanced helicopter rotors in terms of the angle of the wing, and particularly looking at, I mean, if you look at hummingbirds, their wings are really wide compared to how long they are. I mean, you know, birds that soar will have very long wings, but they're kind of narrow, kind of like what you see in jet aircraft. But what you see on a hummingbird is that the wings are almost as wide as they are long. And then kind of the way they're shaped and tilted. Anyway, they did a study showing that this is a phenomenal design, enabling these birds to actually do a helicopter maneuver that is actually more efficient than the best helicopters that we build in terms of their energy output.
And the other one they can't point, obviously, is the same structure as in dragonflies. There's only two animals that can hover, and that's the dragonfly and the hummingbirds can hover and fly backwards. Right. And the dragonfly obviously being an insect has exactly the same efficient design. Right, it does. So
anyway, it just took a few hundred years for the engineers to figure this all out. So, in fact, what the researchers were commenting on, it wasn't until we had this goal of building, you know, more energy-efficient helicopters. I mean, if any of you have been on a helicopter, there's a lot of fuel that's expended for a little distance it travels. It's nowhere near as efficient as an aircraft. And the goal has been, let's see if we can build a helicopter that's more fuel efficient. And that required literally a 20-year project of really trying to improve the design of the rotors. And we look at these hummingbirds and say, you know what? They did it first. So the hummingbirds are quite amazing. Hey, on a completely different subject, a problem in our local cluster of galaxies got solved this week. And, the local cluster in which we live has got two relatively large galaxies and a whole bunch of little ones. The two big boys are the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy. And the rest of them are dwarf galaxies. There's about 100 galaxies in the local group, basically 98 dwarfs, and two not giant galaxies, but big galaxies. Well, when I was growing up, the idea was that the Andromeda galaxy was twice as big as the Milky Way galaxy. And the last 2 years, research has been done to show that our galaxy is predominantly made up of exotic dark matter, ordinary dark matter and exotic dark matter, and that all the stars and remnants of stars you see, it's only 10% of our galaxy. The rest of it is dark matter. Whereas we look at the Andromeda galaxy, it's got more stars, but the presumption was it had a lot less dark stuff. And so for the last 4 or 5 years, the predominant idea is that our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy are the same mass. The difference is they have a dramatically different ratio of dark matter to matter that you can actually see. Well, this paper got published just this week in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, where they've actually done a detailed model of the dynamics of all the galaxies in the local group, and the conclusion is that the Andromeda galaxy has just as much dark matter in it as the Milky Way galaxy does. So we've now been demoted. We're not the biggest galaxy in the local group anymore. We're definitely the second largest galaxy. But that's not what was so exciting about this paper. For the last few years, we've been looking at the local group as being an anomaly in the universe. Because with our Milky Way galaxy having this much dark matter and the Andromeda galaxy having a lot less, literally half as much dark matter, it caused a problem for cosmological models. Because the best Big Bang creation model we have would say that the big galaxies should be roughly the same. And our local group, where we got the best measurements, they weren't the same. And so what's going on here? Well, now we realize that the ratio is the same, we realize that the local group is no longer an anomaly for the best Big Bang creation model. More than that, this is what I think is most exciting of all, the group that did the research had done such an accurate measurement of all the dynamics of these galaxies in the local group that they're actually able to detect the expansion of the universe in the local group. That had never been done before. In fact, the local group is the only set of galaxies where we see blue shifts. Two of the local group galaxies are blue shifted, whereas all the rest of the galaxy in the universe are red shifted. Now that's expected, because these galaxies are sufficiently close to us that the random velocities due to the gravitational interactions between the galaxies actually dominate the velocity from the expansion of the universe. And so, for example, Andromeda is actually coming towards us rather than away from us. But it's because it's so close to us that the gravitational interaction between our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy dominates the expansion of the universe. Well, for the first time, astronomers have actually been able to take out all these local gravitational influences in our local group and see the effect of the expansion of the universe and measure the expansion rate of the universe. Again, this has never been done before, but the figure they came up with is that the Hubble constant, which is a way of measuring the expansion of the universe, comes up with the same value that we get when we look at the expansion of the universe on very large scales. And the error bar, well, a little bit larger error bar, but not much larger. And so we now realize we got a new proof for the Big Bang creation model that we never had before, just based on local dynamics, and no longer is a local group a problem for the Big Bang model. Kind of goes back to what we were saying about the genetics idea. You got an anomaly. Well, before we panic about the anomaly and abandon the idea that the universe really is created 14 billion years ago, let's actually dig in here, make better measurements, fine-tune our theory a little bit, and see if we can actually make things fit. And that's what happened.
To find the local group, I think not everybody knows.
Okay, the local group is a very colorful name astronomers came up with for the cluster of galaxies in which our galaxy exists. Life is only possible if your galaxy lives in a cluster of galaxies. And our cluster is called the local group, just because it's close.
How many galaxies are in that medium?
Well, when I was a student, I was taught there were only 20 galaxies in the local group. We now have found over 100 galaxies in the local group. But most of those galaxies are only a little bit bigger than the globular clusters that orbit about our galaxy. And this also was an anomaly that had bothered astronomers for literally 30 years. Because again, the best Big Bang creation model would predict that you would have a very high ratio of dwarf galaxies to ordinary or medium to large size galaxies. And in our local group, the ratio seemed to be about 5 to 1, or maybe 10 to 1. It's supposed to be like 50 to 100 to 1. And so what happened is astronomers said, let's build more sensitive telescopes because perhaps these dwarf galaxies are dominated by gas and not by stars. And so, you know, these huge telescopes that have just come online finally had the sensitivity to find these things and indeed showed that they were predominantly made up of gas and not stars. Therefore, they're very difficult to detect. So just in the last, 4 to 5 years, the number of dwarf galaxies in our cluster of galaxies has risen from, say, 30 up to more than 100. Now, that fits what we would expect with the Big Bang creation model. And now there's a quest to actually look for these dwarf galaxies on clusters of galaxies that are the next closest to us. And just in the last 6 months, they've been very gratified by the fact that they're finding those dim clusters or dim galaxies. It also solves another problem. Why has our Milky Way galaxy had such a stable spiral structure for the past 10 billion years? And that's a requirement if you want advanced life. You have to live in a spiral galaxy with highly symmetrical arms that is sustained literally for many billions of years. And the problem is, to sustain the spiral structure, your galaxy has to eat. If it stops eating, the spiral structure will collapse. What I mean by eating, it actually has to gobble up these dwarf galaxies. And what happens is it grabs a dwarf galaxy and that puts an infusion of gas into the center of the galaxy that gets streamed out to make the spiral arms. So basically our spiral arms is made up of fresh gas that's making new stars. And that's what our spiral arms are all about. But that means that your galaxy has to keep consuming those dwarf galaxies. And so the fact that we found that these dwarf galaxies are extremely gas-rich means, okay, we only have to eat small ones to get sufficient gas to sustain the spiral structure. We don't have to eat the big ones, because dwarf galaxies come in all different sizes, anywhere from, say, 0.1% to 5% of the mass of our galaxy. Now, if you start consuming the ones that are, say, 3%, 4%, 5% of the mass of our galaxy, it will distort the spiral arm structure. And that's what's happened to the Andromeda galaxy. It's actually had some big dwarf galaxies pass through its structure. I should show you a slide so you can see it, but it would take me a while to find it. But our galaxy has literally been undisturbed. Why? Because it's been feeding on a diet of small dwarf galaxies that are very gas-rich. And evidently, there's still a bunch more of them up there. It also is a prediction that comes from the Big Bang model. So that's another example of how a problem or anomaly has been resolved by doing further research on the theory and the observations. Yes? Okay, good question. When did all this happen? Well, again, I wish I could show you a slide. I didn't think I was going to be going down this path. So, but I could show you a slide of the cosmic background radiation, which basically shows you when the universe was, you know, 385,000 years old, and there are no galaxies, there's no stars, but there's very tiny hot and cold spots. And the hot spots become galaxies and clusters of galaxies. But if you look at that cosmic background radiation map, some of the hot spots are quite tiny and just a little bit warmer than the average temperature. Those are going to make your dwarf galaxies. And of course, when the spots collapse, they will split up into more galaxies. So we got a pretty good understanding, based on our best Big Bang creation models, why we have such a high ratio of dwarf galaxies to medium-sized, big, and giant galaxies. There's a hierarchy there. And that's what's the big anomaly, because we looked at our local group and it didn't obey what was predicted by the Big Bang model. The ratio of dwarf galaxies to the big galaxies was too small. But it was resolved by simply getting better telescope power. Then we saw the ones that were actually a lot smaller. And that actually made us go back to the Big Bang model and say, if we redo the Big Bang model, do we actually get the prediction that most of the dwarf galaxies will be gas rich and small? They did that, and indeed, the better theory. You say, how did they do that better theory? Supercomputers. The new generation of supercomputers actually allowed us to simulate how those hot spots make galaxies, where we're literally putting in a trillion data points. Whereas before, we only had computers that could put in a billion data points. So with these supercomputers, we actually got a more fine-tuned result. And it said, yes, you should be getting galaxies that are small and very gas-rich. And then we're able to get a prediction of the ratio, and we're now finding the same ratio in the local group. Now, we'd love to do that in other clusters of galaxies. The problem is it's going to take bigger telescopes. However, those bigger telescopes are currently being built. They got two in Chile, and one is called the Extremely Large Optical Telescope, and we're talking more than 100 feet in diameter. An optical telescope that's more than 100 feet in diameter. And then they got one called the Ridiculously Large Telescope, which is coming in at about 130 feet in diameter. So, very expensive instruments, but these instruments will actually be able to do the job.
Will it be a 100-foot mirror, the mirror itself?
Well, it's not a single mirror. It's a segmented mirror. I mean, we didn't have the technology to make mirrors that big until recently. And what's happening is you make a whole bunch of small mirrors, put them all together, and each mirror is computer controlled where they distort the surface of the mirror. So you don't have to use as much glass, but you actually need a computer behind each of those little miniature mirrors. So, for example, the Keck telescope in Hawaii, which is 400 inches in diameter, it's 36 mirrors, all kind of segmented together, where they got these little things that are working the figure. In fact, it's more sophisticated than that. The reason why they are actually willing to spend the money to build a 100-foot diameter telescope, they now have computer technology that is so good, they can distort the mirror to balance the distortions that take place in the atmosphere above the mirror. So as the atmosphere is being distorted, they compensate it by distorting the mirror at the telescope, so it's as if there's no atmosphere at all. And you're getting your images as crystal clear as you would if the telescope was in outer space. And, it's thanks to that technology, they said, we can now build these super large telescopes. So, yes?
This is a tangential comment.
That's okay. That's what we do in this class.
Well, we know we have our God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three persons. Well, as you know, we also have the menorah, the sevenfold Spirit of God. How do those relate to one another? What's going on here?
Yeah, the sevenfold Spirit of God. Try and remember the actual biblical text. It's basically talking about the Spirit of God manifests seven different character attributes that are predominant in the personality of the Creator. And I can't remember the exact text, but if we had an Orthodox Jew here, they would know it right away. And I'm pretty sure it's Isaiah. And there's this one verse that basically talks about, the Spirit of God has these seven spiritual attributes. So, it's basically the seven most critical character features of God that show that He's a providential God. So it's basically a statement of the providence of God towards humanity.
Doesn't the Lamb also have seven eyes in Revelation and seven horns?
Yes.
The Lamb of, Jesus, that member of the Trinity is also like this seven of these attributes.
Well,
it might be. I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, and it'd be a mistake to look at that Isaiah text and think that's all the attributes that the Spirit of God has. No, it's seven of many attributes that He has. And again, we need to realize that when you read the Old Testament, it seems to like the number 3, the number 7, the number 12, and the number 40. You see that all over the place.
It's Isaiah 11.
Isaiah 11? Thank you. See, when you got smartphones in the class, it's real easy to find this stuff. So check out Isaiah 11. You'll see these seven attributes. But it's basically something that's done in Orthodox Judaism as a way of worshiping God's providential care of humanity. You know, this is what he does for us. But that's what's going on there in that text.
Well, that menorah is a pretty powerful metaphor that God gave the Jews. You know, very significant.
Well, it was a reminder to the Jews as they carried that menorah. You know, you may be going through persecution now. Times might be tough now. But we worship a providential God. He is going to come through for us. And so, you know, that carried the faith of those Jewish people, just like it should carry our faith. Because, you know, we likewise go through these tough times. And, you know, I was speaking about this Friday night. With randomness and uncertainty, you're going to go through tough times. That's just the way it's going to be. But it's part of God's providence that he takes us through those tough times. That's part of his arsenal of bringing about the end of evil and suffering. But he will provide. And I think that's the symbol of the menorah. You know, God will provide. And, you know, we Christians need to be reminding ourselves just as much as these Orthodox Jews do in their worship. So.
Well, in Hughes, the branches of the menorah are like branches with almond blossoms, I think. And, of course, Jesus says that he is the vine and we are the branches. And so that's the center one, and then you got things that come off there,
right?
Which would be man, and seven would be the number for God. So that whole metaphor, Jesus grabbed and kind of, and of course, oil was in those cups at the end, and of course that would represent the Holy Spirit, and
right.
Yeah,
and the oil is also another symbol for God's providence. So, okay, one more. I think I've got time for one more for you. And this actually ties into our text, because our text in Proverbs 8 is basically talking about how God provided everything we need for civilization. This paper got published literally days ago in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, where they've been trying to find out where all the elements heavier than iron come from. And there's actually two sets of these heavy elements, and the one they're particularly interested in is called the R process elements, which makes up a little more than half of all the elements heavier than iron. But once again, this is an example of an anomaly. Planet Earth has these elements in high abundance. And all of our astrophysical models were telling us this shouldn't be. There's no way our planet should have such a high abundance of these elements, because these elements are very hard for the universe to make. And the model has been that our sun and its planets was born in a giant cluster of stars, where there was 10,000 or more stars all jammed tightly together. And that being the case, we would have been exposed to supernova eruptions, and different supernovae make different suites of these R process elements. And that was our best model until a few days ago as to where we got these R process elements. But there was a problem. Those models did not give the Earth enough of these elements unless you wind up destroying the Earth. I mean, if we're really close to these supernovae, you'll get really enriched, but then that would actually destroy the solar system. So we have to be far enough away where we don't get destroyed, but close enough where we get enriched. But all the models were saying there's no way we're going to get enriched enough to explain these elements we see here on planet Earth. Well, what the paper points out is that there's a missing source of these R process elements that we've overlooked. And the missing source was a merger of two neutron stars. That's an extremely rare event. A neutron star is the aftermath of a supernova eruption. So when a star undergoes a supernova eruption, and if you're not familiar with that, only giant stars will undergo a supernova eruption. And when they do, they literally will outshine the entire galaxy for a period of about 3 months. And so they literally are as bright as 100 billion other stars. But as they go through this explosion, the star is literally reduced to about the size of, well, the star that's left over is less than 10 miles across. And you actually have the star collapsing under its own gravity to such a degree that the star's density, for giving an example, the sun's density is roughly the same as water. The density of a neutron star is millions of times greater. In fact, if you were to take neutron star material, a single cubic centimeter will come in at about 2 billion tons. So extremely dense. So dense, there are no molecules there, there's no atoms there, there's no protons there, there's no electrons there. The electrons and protons are driven by the gravity to be fused to make neutrons. So a neutron star is basically a solid crystal of neutrons, about 10 kilometers in diameter. But what this paper is pointing out is, if you can get two neutron stars to actually merge together and become a black hole, the merger event will actually generate the production of these R-process elements at abundance that explains why Earth has got so many of these things. So the conclusion is, we must have formed in a giant star cluster that had the extremely rare event of two neutron stars merging together close enough to the Earth that it enriched the Earth with sufficient amounts of these R-process nucleides, but not so close that it would actually destroy the planetary system. So, again, another example of anomaly in our Big Bang creation model that has been resolved, but also extremely heightens the fact that we must have had an extraordinarily unique origin, that we literally formed in a way very different than any other star. So, hey, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the fact that a couple of neutron stars decided to get together at the same time that the solar system was forming and gave us this amount of R-process elements. Now, the non-R-process elements has been recognized as a solved problem for some time, so we now sit in a situation where we actually have a good astrophysical explanation for all the elements that exist here on the Earth. But as I said before, when you look at the Earth and compare its abundance of elements, particularly the abundance of elements, well, literally all the elements that we see on the Earth, is that when you compare them what we expect in rocky planets, they're all anomalous. So, and this is something that is now being recognized as a major design feature for the Earth. Yes?
The formation of the planets, did that start to occur while the Sun was still in the star cluster?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So Earth was actually being formed when the Sun was still in this giant cluster of stars. And during the formation process, the entire solar system got kicked out. And we got kicked out by a lucky dynamical thing where some giant stars got in the vicinity of our Sun and gave it a gravitational ejection.
I think it knocked off some planets when it did that.
It shouldn't knock off the planets. The Sun's gravity is strong enough to retain the planets. Now, it might adjust the orbits of the planets a little bit, but it won't cause them to be ejected, unless they're small. Some of the smaller ones might have been ejected away. So we got kicked out. Rather similar to how we get spaceships to Saturn and Jupiter. We wait for the right gravitational alignment of the planets, then we send off a rocket from, say, Cape Canaveral out here in the Santa Barbara area, and take advantage of that gravitational slingshot effect, and that allows us to get to those bodies with 1/20th the energy that would be required without the kick. So evidently the same thing happened with our star and its planets. It got kicked out. But you're right, the kick-out time has to be just right. You don't want to be kicked out too late or too early. Yes, there's a question back there? No, I missed one. Sorry.
You might have said that I didn't catch. What is the definition of an R-process element?
These are the elements heavier than iron. And there's two categories, the R and the S. And we had a good understanding of the S. We've not had a good understanding for the R. As basically referring to elements that are made by a spray of neutrons. And so if you kind of blast iron and other elements with neutrons, you actually build up them into other elements. And so a couple of neutron stars merging together is going to give you quite a blast of neutrons, and the neutron blast will be sufficiently intense that you can make these elements. Now, there's other ways of getting it. The problem is the other ways of getting it, like supernova eruptions, you also get a blast of neutrons. It's not intense enough to explain the R process elements we see here on the Earth. I mean, people, I've been reading these papers, they're saying, well, maybe the right kind of supernova will actually get the abundance level up. But what this paper is pointing out is, yeah, it was a gallant attempt, but we think we got a much better solution. And that's kind of where it is right now. The gallant attempt maybe has something going for it, but this looks like it really does solve the problem. Yes?
Those black holes that they make, is that part of the exotic dark matter or the dark energy or anything?
No, these neutron stars are not made up of exotic matter. However, when neutron stars merge to become black holes, then you can get exotic matter. Because now you've got a pressure that's sufficiently strong to make.
Would that be out around our planet, those dark holes around in that, since you said that our galaxy has a lot of dark energy and matter? Is that?
Well, that's one way you can explain all the exotic dark matter, is to say we got lots of black holes. But if you got that many black holes, you're not going to have stars and galaxies like we see. So the number of black holes in our universe is actually quite small. There's only a few black holes. You know, every galaxy's got one at its center. Big star clusters will typically have one at their center. And there's a few other scattered small ones. That's it. So there's not a lot of them. Which means that this exotic dark matter must be a thinly dispersed gas of particles that date back all the way to the inflation event. And by the way, there is a serious effort going on to find the particles that resulted from the inflation that took place when the universe was a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. I've got friends who are actually looking at the cooling of white dwarfs. And already we're seeing white dwarf stars that are cooling too fast. And what they're saying is that extra cooling, what we're seeing is the decay of exotic dark matter particles. And so there's an effort going on now to see if they can actually confirm that, because the signal to noise ratio right now is about 3. The signal is only 3 times above the noise, which means it's not publishable, although they did come out and say we're seeing a hint. You're allowed to do that. We're seeing a tentative hint that we may be seeing the signal of the decay of exotic dark matter particles. And so that gave them some rationale to say, give us a little more money and we'll observe some more of these white dwarfs that seem to be cooling too fast, because all they did is look at one. To really get the result they need, they're going to have to look at 100 of these white dwarfs. But that effort is going on right now. And it's actually a race as to who's going to discover the first exotic dark matter particle. Astronomers looking at the cooling of white dwarfs, or people at the Large Hadron Collider. And the difference is one experiment costs $15 billion, the other experiment costs a little less than $1 million. So we'll see who wins. Yes?
How do we distinguish between a globular cluster, a star cluster, and a galaxy?
Okay. Globular clusters are very large, dense clusters of stars. And they're probably the oldest stars in our galaxy, although there's two categories. We've got middle-aged globular clusters and extremely old globular clusters. And we call them globular because if you look at the cluster of stars, it basically has a spherical configuration. The reason why is the smallest of these globular clusters will have about 15,000 stars in it. But we're talking 15,000 stars stretched over maybe 5 to 10 light years maximum. So, the nearest star to us is 4.25 light years away. What if there were 1,000 stars between us and the nearest star? You get stars that densely packed together they will self-gravitate into a spherical arrangement. Now, if you look in our galaxy, we'll see what are called open clusters. Open clusters will have anywhere from, say, 30 to maybe 500 members. And because there's so few stars, and again, stretched over many light years, some of them are as big as 100 light years across, they do not take a globular shape. It's basically an irregular shape of stars. And that's because the stars aren't close enough together to force a spherical shape. Now, the largest globular cluster we see in our galaxy is Omega Centauri. And remember we had a star party up in the mountains once? We purposely went in April, which is the only time of the year you can see the Omega Centauri globular cluster from this latitude. But several of you looked through the telescope and saw it's got 10 million stars in it. And these 10 million stars are packed into a volume about 20 light years across. So the stars are really jammed closely together. And because they're jammed so closely together, there's a black hole there. So, not a big black hole, but there is a black hole at the center. And we're now finding that black holes are kind of common in the larger globular clusters. So, orbiting about our Milky Way galaxy is about, well, it's a little more than 150 of these globular clusters.
Now, if you're not part of our galaxy.
No, they are part of our galaxy. But some are close in, a lot of them are orbiting fairly far away. So none of them are close to the Earth, which is good news. You don't want to be close to one of these globular clusters. So that is one of the design features, that the closest one is like 7,000 light years away. So it's not an issue for us. Now, if you were to look at some of the bigger galaxies in the Virgo cluster, some of those, in fact, I got a photo here again, I could pop it up for you, but it would take too long. It has 6,300 globular clusters in it. And the Andromeda galaxy has more clusters, globular clusters than we have. So those are globular clusters, open clusters. Galaxy clusters are clusters of galaxies. Now, clusters of galaxies, the galaxies are jammed far more tightly together, given their size than stars are, even in globular clusters. So, I mean, to give you an idea, if we were to take our star, the Sun, and model it down to the size of a grapefruit, the nearest star, also the size of a grapefruit, would be sitting in Peru or Siberia. So the stars are very far apart. And even if you look at one of the densest globular clusters, the stars are still very far apart. We would be talking, you know, for example, about a mile apart from one another. If you look at a typical cluster of galaxies, or say my fist is the size of a medium-sized galaxy, the next adjacent galaxy would be about here. So galaxies are close together in clusters. And most of the galaxies in the universe are in clusters. There's only a few that are kind of sitting out there outside of clusters.
And would that eliminate them right away from the possibility of having life?
Well, the reason why it would eliminate them is your galaxy cannot retain its spiral structure unless it's consuming small galaxies. And if it's sitting outside a cluster of galaxies, it will not have enough to feed on. And so, yes, that's why you want to be in a cluster. But you don't want to be in too big of a cluster. If you're in too big of a cluster, then there'll be giant galaxies that will be gravitationally bouncing you around.
Well, these guys are looking at the SETI program.
Mm-hmm.
Do they concentrate on areas that would be more favorable based on the data you're giving us?
Well, the SETI people, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligent Life, they're limiting their search to our galaxy and really only the nearby parts of our galaxy, because they don't have the technology to check things out in other galaxies. And there's another good reason why they're not doing that. We don't know of any other galaxy that has the spiral features that would sustain advanced life. I mean, that's what really bothered me about the Star Wars trilogy. Galaxy far, far away? Well, we look far, far away. We don't see any candidates. We're literally living in the only galaxy that's a candidate for advanced life. So that's why SETI is focused on our particular galaxy. But let me tell you something else that's unique about our cluster of galaxies. I was telling you, a typical cluster, the galaxies are about that far apart. And our local group, they're more than this far apart. Sufficiently far apart that the galaxies are not so gravitationally interacting that it would disturb the features of the galaxy that are necessary to sustain life for a long period of time. The other unique feature of our Milky Way galaxy, no giant galaxies. We only have, you know, medium-large sized galaxies, and there's only two of them. If you look at any other cluster of galaxies, it's dominated by these giant galaxies. And that will give you gravitational disturbances. It also means you're not going to see much. If you're an astronomer in one of those clusters of galaxies, there's going to be so many big, bright galaxies in your vicinity, you're not going to see anything outside that cluster. And so we live in a cluster of galaxies where astronomers can actually measure the entire theoretically observable universe. Where in any other cluster, it wouldn't work. And we're outside a cluster, then we wouldn't be able to have life sustained long enough to get advanced light.
So that is amazing. You live in a very dark spot, and so we have the maximum amount of light.
We do. Hey, as we close, one thing I found out on a trip to Canada was how many people are participating in this class through paradoxes.org. I mean, I can tell you that the what we're seeing here is about one-tenth of the class participation. So Richard, thank you for maintaining that website. A lot of people told me to personally thank you for maintaining that site. The other thing they said is, what happened to Al Feynman? And I said, well, he went to Toronto. And they said, well, are you guys in Paradoxes going to recruit another Hollywood comedian? So I says, no, we're just going to have to try to upgrade the humor of the people who are already part of the class. So I'm counting you to do that. But you know, people enjoy kind of the personal interaction that takes place here in the class. So thank all of you for making that happen and making it so popular. And we'll see what we can do about recruiting another professional comedian to keep things light here in the class.
Like another Nella D, too.
Well, Al Feynman is actually participating, so I think he's going to hear that, so we'll see. Well, let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for this amazing week of scientific discovery that really demonstrates, Lord, the depth of your provision for us to be able to sustain the population that we have here on the earth, its advanced civilization. And Father, we thank you that the number of people you've chosen to be redeemed is not a small number. You've actually designed this earth to support a huge population of human beings. And Father, we look forward to fellowship with a redeemed host that you've ordained from literally before the universe was created, before even time existed. Thank you, Lord, that when you created, it was with redemption in mind. In Jesus' name, amen.